paper 38, which is old single column, page 418. All right, so we've been working our way through the assortment of local universe personalities that have some immediate relevancy to the Ascension career. So they're part of this slice that the Revelators have given us through the total system of beings in the universe of universes. And we're now to the part of that slice of the whole that very much has a lot to do with the Ascension career, the Seraphim. And as they start into this, one of the first things that they're going to want to be doing, you might guess, is taking the various passages in the Bible, that, or if not in the Bible, in the the history of human thinking about angels, any the various threads of ideas about angels that have been circulating for centuries, if not millennia, right? And try to begin to nudge that, that very scattered, tangential phenomenon that is sort of angelology, into something that they can bring into relationship with the facts on high. And when you're dealing with a phenomenon that is that has captivated human imagination as much as angels have, a phenomenon that has captured the imagination as much as angels, there's obviously going to be a number of issues that you're going to come up against when the Revelators try to start to sort that out for you. So you have to be ready to be brave and let them lead you from a concept of angels that probably you've been quite satisfied with to one that you can't imagine beforehand that you could be more satisfied with. But in that sort of a case, when it isn't just something that you've never thought about before, they're introducing brand new to you, and it's something that you maybe have thought about a lot, you shouldn't be surprised if you're reading a revelation, not an affirmation, that they could be challenging you a little bit. They'll try to be as gentle as possible. The revelation is constructed to be an evolutional text so that it synchronizes with evolutionary ideas as seamlessly as possible. But nonetheless, they would like to get us beyond what's bound to be quite anthropomorphic and materialistic in terms of ideas about angels to something that is more literal and part of the cosmic system. All right, once they get you through that initial part, then you start to get a little bit more directly elements that are, sort of beyond any sort of immediate ideas that humans have had. But we start out kind of where we are and then move from there. All right, so let's jump in and see what they've got for us here.
Paper 38, Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe. There are three distinct orders of the personalities of the Infinite Spirit. The impetuous apostle understood this when he wrote respecting Jesus, who has gone to heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject to him. Angels are the ministering spirits of time, authorities, the messenger hosts of space, powers, the higher personalities of the infinite spirit.
Okay, so who's the impetuous apostle?
Peter,
of course. Always wanting to boldly dash forth. Okay, and so that's from 1 Peter, you know, that first letter of Peter's that we know from the Revelation, you know, served as a cover letter. So he's got that passage, you know, pretty much directly like you see it there. And, you know, I mentioned angelology. Part of that is lots of musings about all sorts of different types of celestial beings that you might, you know, in general call angels. Okay, but for those who are serious about this, they have people have come up with lots of different types of celestial beings, some that they would call seraphim and others that they would call other things. And they basically have mined all of the human writings that we have for any sort of a name that they could latch onto to designate a group of celestial beings with. This is a classic. So you have a long-standing belief in a type of celestial being designated angel, or angels, and a type of celestial being designated authorities, and a type of celestial being designated powers, and a whole bunch of other categories that, you know, that people have come up with. But those are three biggies. See, and especially because they're right there together, and they very much, you know, it seems like Peter was talking about three groups of beings, you know, and people picked up on that. It's like, well, it's kind of an odd name, authorities and powers, but you know, I mean, technically angel just means messenger, so, okay, we'll go with it, and we'll believe in authorities, and we'll believe in powers, as well as believing in angels. Okay, so if you're familiar with all of that, you know, and the 58 other categories, and all the hierarchy in angelology and stuff, you might be, you know, have decided at some point, and that seems like that's a whole bunch of fairy tales and stuff. Okay, there's angels, but all that other stuff. Okay, so look what the first thing that the revelators do. Yes, he is the impetuous apostle, and, you know, likes to leap before he thinks, but he understood this, it says. Okay, so that's an interesting little tidbit. They are saying that probably, you know, because of things that Jesus said to Peter, maybe Jesus used those three terms even, you know. So maybe Peter is just repeating what Jesus called them. But the revelators here are validating that, confirming that those are meant to represent three different groups. And they're now telling you who they are. You know, let's assume that Jesus did, you know, coin those terms for him. So Jesus told him to think about a group of beings called authorities. And they're saying, okay, now technically who those quote-unquote authorities are the messenger hosts of space. It's like, well, okay, so we've studied the messenger hosts of space not that long ago. There's one that always comes to mind first in that list, the conciliating commissions, right? Universe conciliators, the executioner of the Ancients of Days. Sounds pretty authoritative, yeah. Right? All right, those roving courts that are the local authority that make rulings, okay? And then, you know, without even, you know, thinking about any of the specific groups, but just tying the powers term to the higher personalities of the infinite spirit. You know, the powers that be, those on high, the higher personalities. Right, so, you know, and then you could wonder if, you know, like if we're assuming that Jesus may have given him that term for that group, you know, what might have Jesus been kind of thinking of in terms of a quote-unquote power? Well, you literally have, you know, the circuit supervisors. When there's a rebellion, the powers that be cut the circuit, for instance. You know, so you can immediately, you know, think about how those two words is just a one-word name, something that they could relate to, you know, especially in the context of God the Almighty, you know, sort of that aggrandized Yahweh, sort of, you know, way of thinking about God, authority, power, sovereignty, you know, et cetera. All right, so that's an interesting little tidbit. You know, they don't explain whether or not somehow if Peter just knew this, you know, in some way, or if it actually was, you know, fed to him by Jesus. But one way or another, he understood this. You know, understood that there are three distinct orders of personalities. Okay, yeah, so like we were just reminding ourselves, we went through the higher personalities and the messenger hosts way back, you know, many papers ago, and we went through a whole bunch of higher, quote-unquote, angels, Supernaphim, Seconaphim, you know, even Tertiaphim, Omniphim, yeah, and now we're focusing down to the ones that are actually in the local universe, the Seraphim. All right, and so in general, like the title of the paper, they're the ministering spirits of time, not the ministering spirits of eternity. That would be a higher angel, the ministering spirits of time. All right, you always want to just, you know, make sure you appreciate how much effort the revelators put into trying to give you a text that wasn't too jarring, that tried to say, well, now, you know how you thought about that. Okay, that isn't all foolishness. Yeah, but you notice they didn't validate the other 16 categories or whatever we have, you know, in the notion of angelology. But, right, but they try to give you something to hold on to so that you feel comfortable to a degree, and then they're going to try to challenge you a little bit. Yeah, so not surprisingly, right up front, they give you that, which, you know, you might not have even ever heard of if you aren't heavily into angels, and if you weren't raised Catholic, you might not have even been aware that there was anything besides angels in people's minds, you know, for a name for celestial beings. But there definitely is. All right, so let's get into it here.
As the Supernaphim in the central universe and the Seconaphim in a super universe, so the Seraphim, with the associated cherubim and Seraphim, constitute the angelic core of a local universe.
You might ask why they didn't just attach that to the next paragraph. They did want you to pause there and remind yourself that they couldn't tell you something right there. All right, what's missing from that paragraph? You know, so you're talking about the local universe, and they say Seraphim and the associated cherubim and seraphim constitute the angelic core. Well, asterisk, you know, except for the unrevealed order of angels. Yeah. Right. Remember, that's always in play, that there's that whole other order of angels that are not spoken of in general. You know, so they purposely just gave you that little kind of stub. And, you know, and you go, why did they, you know, why didn't they just combine those two paragraphs? So it's just, you know, there's little things like that they do. Yeah, it's sort of, you know, wait a minute, you know, there's a blank space there, you know, where that previous, you could put something else in there, you know. You know, it's just, that's why they did that.
Put a space in there.
So you could write in, the, and the lesser order of angels.
The Seraphim are all fairly uniform in design. from universe to universe throughout all seven of the super universes, they show a minimum of variation. They are the most nearly standard of all spirit types of personal beings. Their various orders constitute the core of the skilled and common ministers of the local creations.
Okay, now that might be a little, see, now we're getting a little bit beyond the immediate, and that might be a little tidbit you'd forgotten about, even if you've been reading for a long time. That seraphim are pretty interchangeable parts, not just in a super universe, but throughout the whole grand universe. Yeah, that's that. Throughout all seven of the super universes, they're fairly uniform. Well, that's kind of interesting because in Creative Mother Spirits, you know, remember when we were going into the details of Creative Mother Spirits, they're, you know, quite uniform in terms of their nature. I mean, obviously each of their personalities is absolutely unique, but in terms of the nature of a Creative Mother Spirit, they're quite uniform throughout the whole super universe because they all, you know, get flavored, you know, colored, whichever, you know, analogy you want to use, by a single master spirit before they're sent out. And they go into the, they're immersed in a particular master spirit before they go out with the Creator Son. You know, so they're all pretty much the same in the super universe, but it's going to vary from super universe to super universe. But here are these seraphim, their children are in a way a notch above that specificity of a super universe. Okay, well, think about that. You have a creative mother spirit. There's spirit type deity and mother type deity in a creative mother spirit. Obviously, the spirit part is what's directly tied back to a particular master spirit and back to the infinite spirit. So just that little tidbit, if you're thinking about it logically, you know, is telling you that these seraphim are much more, you know, they're sort of biased to being the offspring of the mother aspect of the creative mother spirit than the spirit aspect. Otherwise, they wouldn't be kind of transcending the specificity of the master spirits. It must be, you know, and we know about that. You know, when you think about the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart here and the hierarchy of the mothers, you know, if we're talking about a being that is really, you want to not so much think of as being the offspring of a particular mother, a particular creative mother spirit in this case, but more the offspring of mother in general, you know, sort of hierarchy, you know, level in the hierarchy, independent a little bit more, more just a daughter of the mother, you know, above the individual super universe level with the reflective mother spirits, there is a collective mother domain, the level of the collective super universe level. You know, those creative mother agencies in the ancients of days. That certainly is uniform, you know, across all seven. And there's even shades of it, as we, you know, we remind ourselves, with the reflective mother spirits. You have a sevenfoldness. There's seven reflective spirits in each super universe, one of each super universe flavor. But they're one mother. See, so even with the reflective mother spirits, you have shades of that mother presence that's more ubiquitous throughout the whole grand universe than, you know, just localized specific to a particular super universe. Okay, so all of that, you know, is there to be appreciated just in that opening little salvo that they gave you there. They put that up front. They want you to have that sort of in the back of your mind as you read forward. So there might be something that they say that might be more straightforward to interpret. If you remind yourself that there is some non-locality to these local universe angels. They're made locally, but they obviously are built for the future and with the future in mind.
Didn't we borrow some angels before Michael?
We'll get there. Oh. You're jumping ahead. You're going to read that in just a minute.
I hope
not. Yep, we're going to read about that in just a minute. Just thinking about that, that fact, it's like, well, even with what little I can remember about angels, that makes sense. Because I remember that when I ascend to paradise, a pair of angels go with me. Right, so they have to be built to be able to span vertical levels innately. They may function for long spans of time in a horizontal mode, so that they're kind of stationary children, like those sort of quasi-stationary permanent citizens we were just reading about at the end of the previous paper. But, they have to have the potential without too much complication to be able to shift gears and span the spectrum, and what fundamentally is spanning that whole vertical spectrum? Not spirit deity, mother deity is that vertical, spectrum of deity. So if they're biased, to that side, that's just innate in their nature. That they're going to be transcendent fundamentally of even the seven master spirit differential. So they can, they're ready for the central universe and transcending the seven super universes. They're ready for the Isle of Paradise. They're ready for the core of the finality. Right, just by their initial nature. All right. It's always fun to really kind of challenge yourself to see if you can figure out why they decided to take certain points and put them in a preface. Obviously they've got all kinds of things they want to tell you. Why did they put the particular things that they did in the preface? And see if you can speculate on that, and then put it to the test and see if it works. See if your guess helps you interpreting what follows. Okay, so origin of seraphim. Oh, maybe I should just say up front, since we mentioned angelology. Remember that when you say seraphim to someone who is really into the whole history of angels and the use of that term seraphim, you've got some fixed ideas about that of six wings and these sorts of things, quickly becomes apparent that they're not going to validate any of that for you, and so if you aren't familiar with all of that specificity, it's helpful actually. To not have to overcome all of those very precise visuals that have been attached to these various names. Because, of course, they're not saying that what you have called seraphim exists any more than they're saying what you've called archangels exists. They're just using those names in an appropriate way. All right.
Seraphim are, one, origin of seraphim. Seraphim are created by the universe mother spirit, and have been projected in unit formation 41,472 at a time ever since the creation of the pattern angels and certain angelic archetypes in the early times of Nebadon. The Creator Son and the universe representation of the Infinite Spirit collaborate in the creation of a large number of suns and other universe personalities. Following the completion of this united effort, the sun engages in the creation of the material suns, the first of the sex creatures, while the universe mother spirit concurrently engages in her initial solitary effort at spirit reproduction. Thus begins the creation of the seraphic hosts of a local universe.
Okay. Just begins, you know, and they'll tell you in a minute here that it's very much an ongoing phenomenon. Okay, so we don't have the specifics yet, but eventually we'll get to that section here in this paper, where they point out that that's not just a general statement, that they are projected in unit formation, but you literally have a specific group designation, you know, group, quote unquote, or grouping, maybe I should say, not to be confusing there, designation, called a unit. You know, the military sorts of designations. And there are 41,472 in a unit, you know, in contrast to companies and battalions and this sort of thing. Okay, so so that's the, even though there's smaller groupings, they're birthed a unit at a time. All right, and then part of the unrevealed aspect here is you've got some beings that are being designated quote unquote pattern angels, and then some other beings that are being designated archetypes, angelic archetypes, no explanation, but it is interesting that they made that distinction. Sounds to me, you know, to say pattern angel is hinting at, you know, more of the realityizing aspect of it. I mean, you talk about spirit pattern, energy pattern, pattern. Okay, whereas just archetype maybe is more just about the basic nature of them. I mean, I don't know, I'm just kind of guessing. I'm trying to feel what this contrast might be. But certainly when you say pattern, you know, if the revelators say pattern, that's not just, I mean, you know, if you look up archetype, it might say pattern, you know, is, you know, meaning of that. Okay, yeah, but they're distinguishing. Okay, so, you know, maybe it's more pattern angels and, you know, model angels, you might say, that the angels are modeled after the archetypes, but patterned after the pattern angels. You know, I'm bringing in a contrast between actuality and reality in some way. Maybe that's what it's at. I'm just guessing. But
maybe it's a functional thing where the pattern angels help with the form of others more, and the archetype is more of the ideal look too.
Right, again, so everyone can kind of just speculate. See, they obviously are just, you know, but it is interesting that they gave you two. It makes you kind of wonder if you could somehow think about this in a more advanced fashion. You know, that would lock into place. You'd appreciate why they gave you that little hint there for some reason. Okay, but, all right, so we have... Remember how we briefly mentioned the material sons and daughters? We had that, they were telling us that we have this, we go through a phase of creation where the two of them are creating as a pair, the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit. And then they mentioned that subsequent to that, the Creator Son did the material sons and daughters on his own. Okay, and now, as they point out, at the same time, she's doing this on her own, bringing at least the seraphim. You know, we don't quite know where the cherubim, sanabim, lesser angels, whatnot fit into this, but at least the seraphim are being done at the same time with the material sons and daughters. And you know, we'll get to it in a minute, but as long as it's kind of right here, you know, since they you know, they mention the first of the quote unquote sex creatures. The angels aren't sex creatures. Even, you know, they have that duality to them, that polarity to them. You know, if you think about the nature that we talked about with the Creator Son, how we could understand how a Creator Son could give rise to both a material son and a material daughter. It's because he's actually, his parents were, were the universal father as the universal creator, and the eternal son as the eternal mother son, technically the coordinate creator with the universal creator, making a creator son. But you had a definite, very overt father deity, mother deity coming together there to give rise to that creator son. So the mother deity is recessive, yes, but it comes out here, and they make, and he can make a material daughter. With the creative mother spirit, it's like, well, don't I maybe have the possibility there too? Because I have, I have the spirit on the one side, and the mother on the other side. The two types of deity and a creative mother spirit, isn't there kind of the same sort of thing? I mean, don't they often talk about, the third person is a he? So wouldn't there be a he, she, polarity there that could give rise to actual sex creature differential? Well, first of all, it's not the conjoined actor that's being downstepped as a creative spirit. It's the infinite spirit. And they just mentioned it right there, the representation of the infinite spirit, not the representation of the conjoined actor. Okay, so that's it, more than he. So that diminishes the possibility right there when you think about it clearly, and you notice that they made a point of even reminding you of that there. And then on top of it, what did we point out in that preface? They gave us the clue that it's biased to the mother's side in the first place. So that again lessens the possibility that there's some sort of right in the middle, he, she differential, going on in this creative act. So actually when you think about it definitively, it's not surprisingly that she wouldn't be giving rise to sex creatures in this act, but they do have a polarity. But that's, again, reasonable, because she does have a polarity within her. There's two types of deity. Okay, so there's a polarity, but it's definitely biased to the mother's side, as they've hinted here. Okay.
These angelic?
Mm-hmm.
These angelic orders are projected at the time of planning for the evolution of mortal will creatures. The creation of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality by the universe mother spirit, not as the later coordinate of the master son, but as the early creative helper of the creator son. Previous to this event, the seraphim on duty in Nebadon were temporarily loaned by a neighboring universe.
All right, so there it is. Just like you were remembering, Maria, there, yeah, so... As we can tell, there was a whole bunch of, all these beings we've been reading about came into existence prior to this, and we're starting to get the whole structure of the local universe set up, and they obviously needed helpers, and they weren't birthed yet, so we had loners from a neighboring universe. You're wondering if it's Avalon again, like it seems like it so often is, anyway, they're there. So that's just reminding you in between the lines that the angels aren't just going to be helping us. They're very much helping all these beings we've been reading about. All right, and then the other things. Now, you notice they made a point of repeating the word. In the first sentence of the previous paragraph, they said, have been projected in unit formation. Here they do it again. These angelic orders are projected. Why are they purposely using that word projected and repeating it to stress it like that? That's a little bit of an advanced issue, but that's reminding you of an aspect of the nature of mother deity. that it's appropriate to use the designation projected with that aspect of her nature. And without going into any of the details, it means that there's totality attitude in play.
We're taking providence.
Okay. It means there's totality attitude. Okay, we had that thing in the preface. We noticed they were suggesting there was a lot of sort of totality attitude to their nature, that they weren't very localized in their fundamental type of beingness. Yeah, so that's what's going on there. So that's sort of total deity things that you can pull out of this, what that's related to. The other thing there, if you think about that, that might strike you as a little odd. Okay, so it's saying the creation of seraphim dates from the attainment of relative personality by the universe mother spirit. And okay, if they didn't say anything else, you'd think, okay, well, I know they mentioned personality coming into play in two points. One, when creator son and creative mother spirit, or the creative spirit, when the creator son and the creative spirit decide they're going to start bringing beings into existence. You have the primary eruption, and it becomes a she, and you actually have a creative mother spirit at that point, and more definitively personal. And then they mention that once the creator son became a master son, she became all the more personal. Oh, but that was only 2,000 years ago, so I would never even think of assuming that the angels only date from 2,000 years ago. Where did my mythology prior to Pentecost, come from then, about angels? But you notice they said it, not as the later coordinate of the master son. And you're going, why did you waste time telling me something so trivially obvious as that? But as the early creative helper of the creator son. Okay, so you've got a little mystery there. Why did they seemingly waste a little bit of space in the book on such a trivially obvious statement that angels are older than 2,000 years old? How could the angels have fallen victim to the rebellion? It's just so trivially obvious, which fact it is, it's tied to. Okay, remember when we were going through that, to understand literally what's going on, you have a being that's coming down, mother deity, the part that actually is personalizable definitively is the mother deity. And that's a downwelling phenomenon always in the universe. And remember how as we were reading through a creative spirit coming into existence, we noted the point when it was at the co-absolute level. It's coming down from the infinite mother spirit up at the co-infinite level, and it's coming down towards the finite, and it passes through the co-absolute, etc. And as it's getting down, when it finally starts to penetrate and have some relationship to the finite directly, there's going to be, at least for higher beings, some recognition of personality now. Before that, the personality was transfinite and not recognizable by finite beings. But there was a personality there. That's why the creator son, related to her as a person when no one else could, because he can relate to her transfinitely. Okay. But it eventually penetrates down, and at least the higher beings can recognize a measure of personality now to that being. Now, not just entity, but being. And then when he achieves that relationship with the Supreme, with the seventh bestowal, and becomes a master son, she reciprocally penetrates further down. He sort of is, going up and engaging the Supreme, and she's penetrating down reciprocally and having a very definitive expression now down in the finite. And so even lowly beings can recognize the personality, of her individuality. So that's what they're referring to. Oh, so they're reminding me that the part of her that is giving birth to these seraphim is not the her that is way down deep, embedded in the local universe as a finite phenomenon. It's the part that's more transcendent. It's mother, relative to the finite. It's not just a transfinite mother. It's definitely mother relative to the finite. But see, it's going to be at that higher level. Yes, that's what they were reminding us in the preface, that the part of her that's giving rise to these seraphim is not the part of her that's way down at the tip of the focus down into the local universe. It's actually up there, quite transcendent of a lot of the details in the universe of universes. It's the higher mother aspect of her. What was there once she first became a mother, once she first manifests as a person. That's why they did that.
But they're being created all along.
Right, so even now when she's making them, she's not making them with that part that's way down there. She's making it with the part of her that's up there still. Because remember, it isn't like she's not like a disc that's lowering down from the co-infinite level. She has everything all the way up. She's like that adjuster, that we think of as an infinite rod, that's connected to the infinite level on the one end and penetrates down into the finite eventually on the other end, and it's continuous.
Would that be to facilitate those seraphim being able to transcend?
Right, that's my whole point. See, just in order, you're just trying to put it together logically. There's no way that all by herself she can create a high being as a low being.
Right.
Okay, now if you had a super additive consequence, you could imagine, two lower beings giving rise to something that's higher, but she's doing this all by herself. Mm-hmm. Right? So she has to do it as a high being, mm-hmm. not as the low being that she can now function as. But the higher mother that she's been for a very, very long time, way back somewhere in between 300 billion years ago and 200 billion years ago. Probably closer to the 300 billion, right? All right, so that just notice these little kind of glitches like that, apparently, that are trying to get you to pause and ask yourself a logical question. Why on earth did they say something so obvious like that? Okay, or like we did up there, why did they take those little factual things and make them a separate little paragraph? Why didn't they just add that on to the next paragraph? Why do they do these little things? Everything has a purpose. And see if you can strike step with the revelators, get in their mind and see why they're doing this stuff. Okay. All right, so there we have it again. So it's pretty definitive now. See, we understand what's going on. She's, maybe when she makes those, maybe she makes beings now that are very, much low down, maybe she can, for the last 2,000 years, maybe she can make beings now that she couldn't make before, okay? But seraphim are not it. She continues to make them at a very high level. So that they can ascend all the way on high. The only reason you can ascend to the Isle of Paradise is because you have something that connects you all the way up there. A spirit fuser can only ascend to the local universe capital because that's as high as their rod goes, right? They ascend up to the top of the rod that they're given, that spirit fragment, and they reach the top of it. If you're a sun fuser, you ascend to the top, the local universe, because that's a fragment of the reflective mother spirits, and that's as high as that rod goes, that fragment.
So now she's creating the unrevealed ones.
who knows what she's up to, yeah.
To understanding her nature, that's a pretty important disclosure.
Right, yeah. And see, it all has to do with, if you're trying to understand this without Mother Deity, you have no literal way to do this, okay? That's the key, because that's that vertical spanning phenomenon. And we've used that many, many times, as we've gone through these papers. In order to actually understand the logic of what's going on, you have to have something that can span the levels vertically. Right? Yeah.
Perhaps when she's creating on this more localized
area, maybe some of these angels that are unreferred to that we don't talk about.
Well, see, you know, right. See, you might think about that, those lesser angels.
Yeah.
But of course, remember, the leader of those lesser angels was, you know, is mentioned working with Dan and stuff right after the rebellion 200,000 years ago. Sorry. So she's been making those angels for a long time, too. I mean, she's been, you know, the first planet 200 billion years ago, inhabited planet, needed those lesser angels. So, right, see, so there's some mystery there of, you know, has she started? I mean, you know, Michael can't, you know, make new beings now because he would be making transfinite things. He's got supreme type deity glued to him now. And but does that free her up to make some beings that, you know, she couldn't make before? Like I said, the fact that he's all that, you know, is very definitively high, that means she's penetrates farther down than she can, and so her creative energy could come out at a lower level than it could before. Maybe for the last 2,000 years, there's unrevealed beings, you know, that were, you know, that maybe they were even unexpected. You know, you never know, you know, by the local celestials. Who knows? Just lots of area for speculation there. Anyway, all right, So this is what's going on. You've got her creating at some of her higher creative levels on her own to make these seraphim.
Right. Two, angelic natures.
Oh, wait, we didn't do that last.
No.
Oh, there I did it. I must have read this recently because I keep doing this. Seraphim are still being periodically created. The universe of Nebadon is still in the making. The universe, Mother Spirit, never ceases creative activity in a growing and perfecting universe. Yeah.
So she's still doing this, you know, but the very fact that they give you that last sentence, never ceases, see, that just makes it all the more suggestive. The speculations we were just doing, that even though he has had to cease, she never ceases. Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there may be all kinds of beings that are indispensable to a local universe being able to get settled in light and life that can't even be created until the Creator Son becomes a Master Son, for instance.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Who knows what's in that just vast space of unrevealed beings that are related to the Infinite Spirit, in this case, in a downstepped fashion. All right.
Two, angelic natures. Angels do not have material bodies, but they are definite and discrete beings. They are of spirit nature and origin. Though invisible to mortals, they perceive you as you are in the flesh without the aid of transformers or translators. They intellectually understand the mode of mortal life, and they share all of man's non-sensuous emotions and sentiments. They appreciate and greatly enjoy your efforts in music, art, and real humor. They are fully cognizant of your moral struggles and spiritual difficulties. They love human beings, and only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them.
Okay, before we go into those details there, notice the important bottom line that they put there, okay? They don't want you to lose what you might definitely have from evolutionary notions of angels. So they emphasize it as the bottom line of their opening paragraph here when they're getting into the details. They love human beings. And only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them. Okay, so they want you to hold that very strong. But like I was saying up front, there's a reason why they want you to hold that very strong, because they're going to tell you some things about angels, you know, if not here in other papers, that are going to shatter some of your illusions and things, okay? And they don't want you to lose sight that even though they aren't everything you imagined, in real terms, in terms that you will appreciate not just now, but forevermore, they are what you've imagined. hold on to what's real, and then be willing to let the other stuff evolve a little bit. All right. Well, you know, angels do not have material bodies. That's not, you know, too tough. I mean, pretty much, you know, everyone who's imagined angels haven't thought of them that anthropomorphically. Okay. You know, like I often say, you know, very almost sacrilegiously, if not irreverently, you know, they aren't the buxom winged things of art, right? Okay, they aren't that anthropomorphic. You know, and when you do that, if you, you know, depict them like that, I mean, if you think about it logically, you're basically saying that they have material bodies. I mean, you're making them sex creatures, you know, and like material sons and daughters. And, you know, they just told you, no, they're not material sons and daughters. So don't think of them in sex terms, okay? And they stress, they share, you know, your basic intellectual nature, you know, except the sensuous, you know, emotions and sentiments. Because, again, they're not sex creatures, so there's no way they could have mind phenomena that are directly tied to those material aspects of sex differential. Okay, but you know that's starting to eat into some people's ideas a little bit. You know, there's definitely, I mean, why do we depict them that way in art? You know, we do have sort of a longing to want them to be a little bit too much like us here. You know, to be the friend you never had, to be the parent that you lost. You know, why do we do this? You know, see, so it's getting into tough territory, you know. A lot of people live a very lonely, troubled life, and that's about all they have to hold on to, is some very literal anthropomorphic angel that they believe is right there with them and you know, comforts them in the same way their mom would have if she hadn't died, say. You know, so, you see, they're trying to be gentle, but, you know, see, between the lines, notice what they're doing. They're trying to get us moved away from something that's too anthropomorphic. Okay, but they do have definite and discrete bodies, okay? So the old notion of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, okay, not an infinite number. I mean, they occupy a given volume. You know, they have definite and discrete bodies. Okay, you know, you could, if one was standing in front of you, you could, you know, take a pen and trace their outline. Okay, they're not some fuzzy being that, you know, just spreads off into infinity in some way or something. They have a skin. They have a boundary. Okay, where they're inside of that volume and not outside of that volume, just like you. Okay, so you can't put an infinite number of them in this room. There's some finite number that will fit into this room. Okay, but they are, you know, quote unquote, of spirit nature and origin. Oh, well, we just got into that quite a bit. You know, last time we were talking about midway creatures. Right, so we know what they're getting at there. They have an energy nature that is not exactly like ours, but not too far from ours. It definitely has more of that spirit-like energy substance aspect to it than I do. None. Okay, I'm just a blob of matter for my body. And so, you know, we're just trying to, you know, hopefully you're kind of getting used to this idea of just having more variability in an energy system for a body than what matter allows for. But it's still very much like molding a blob of clay into a given shape, this whatever energy it is. It has a definite form. But if one's standing here, my hand passes right through that definite form. But technically, now it's outside of that definite form, now it's inside that definite form, and now it's outside that definite form. Even though I can't see it, my hand passes through it, technically I could see it. You know, my hand would be outside, inside, and outside again as I swept, you know, my hand in front of me.
Where I have trouble with this is when they describe them as affectionate and compassionate and loving. Mm-hmm. And just from my, if you could imagine watching 300 billion years of a bloodbath, of a carnage, and we only see a piece of it. They see it all at once. Mm-hmm. You have to have a pretty detached or tough ability to witness such suffering.
Right. So you brought a very important thing to the head right there. You know, that's kind of going to come up directly here in shortly. It just, you know, and it's very important that you said that as a female. Okay. There's nothing more important to appreciate in this deanthropomorphizing of seraphim than to remember they do not have the maternal instinct that you do. Because they're not a sex creature. Well, so that's the challenge, see. Can you separate compassion in your mind from your maternal instinct? That's what it's challenging you as a female to do. Now, I don't have that immediate challenge as a male, but, you know, abstractly at least, I can contemplate that, you know, that their feelings towards us don't have any of that very material level oomph to them, energy to them. They're just naturally, you know, can be back from it a bit. I mean, how difficult is it for, the most poignant thing, like I said, is thinking about the relationship between a mother and a child, you know, because you know we're about to call them she's, you know we're about to call angels she's, see, so we need to think about this, okay? You can't make them a sex creature she, because then it's illogical. You've got, just like you were saying, it doesn't make sense. How could they watch millions of babies slaughtered constantly, okay? You know, so that, you know, it is very difficult for a human mother, even when she's way past menopause and everything, to just think of their child as just another human. I mean, how hard is it for a mother to not, even when she's 95 years old, to be still thinking, you know, of her 75-year-old child or 85-year-old, or, you know, 80-year-old child, you know, the same way, you know, that she did when she was 20, okay? So that really brings it to a point, you know, to appreciate that's not there. It's not because they're cold. It's just that they were made above the level where the mind has any stimulus to take those kinds of forms. There's no input into their mind that can give rise to that kind of a form that you feel so poignantly, you know, not only as a female, but as a mother. Okay. Right, so that's part of what's the process here. What you're looking for is a kind of compassion that a true male and a true, you know, true mortal male and a true mortal female could have equally. A kind of compassion that transcends my, you know, very hormonal-based nature and your very hormonal-based nature. See, so in a way, it's trying to teach you where we could both go just as mortals, where we could go up to a higher level of feeling for others that isn't so driven by our biology. And we would be more angelic in our mind, in our consciousness, if we did that. But the challenge is to not stick them into a dichotomy the moment you start talking, like, oh, so now they just lost all of that, you know, that warmth that I've, no, They love human beings, right? That's, like I said, that's why they put that right there, so that you don't lose that. You know, anything that we say doesn't change that fact that they love human beings more than you've ever imagined being able to love a human being, right? But they love at a sixth level of meaning and not at a first level of meaning.
They know what love is.
Right, right. Right. If they do that, the celestials aren't pained to call that love, right? Like they're pained to use that word because they know what we're immediately going to think, something down there on the first or second level of meaning that we're going to call love. It's like, no, don't. So grotesque, right? Is what they would say.
You know, they're talking about our effort, not that we could actually do it.
Right. And only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them. See, to take delight in cultivating, moving up, so that you can have those higher emotions. Yeah. And it doesn't hurt, you know, if they throw in things like, they appreciate and greatly enjoy your efforts in music, art, and real humor. And of course, they also mean real art and real music, especially as the 20th century rolled on, you know, and we went into pre-primitivism, okay, where, you know, there's almost nothing that's worthy, you know, of this association with an angel. All right, so again, the challenge to put music, art, humor, love, passion, you know, any of those concepts at the highest level possible, get it above the difference between male and female, get it to where it was, you know, with Jesus of Nazareth. Right? All right, anything? Oh yeah, then there's like a whole bunch of things in here. Okay, then that other bit about, we talked about this before too, and we were thinking about the midwayers. You have this very fascinating, not equally bidirectional phenomenon of awareness, that they're fully aware of us as we are. You know, they don't need any transformers to kind of, you know, make a, you know, an avatar of you that they see, right? And they don't need some translator, you know, to translate your English into something that their mind, you know, they relate to you as an English conscious mind, you know, and a blob of protoplasm. They relate to you just exactly as you are, even though we can't see them, hear them, you know, anything, you know. So that's a fascinating thing, again, about this whole energy spectrum, about how it can kind of look down, but you can't look up in it. That's very interesting how that works. But the easiest way here, especially, to appreciate, they have a very immediate relationship to you as a mind, as a mindal self. Okay, and then they sort of get the rest of you from that starting point. You know, they are, you know, when they look at you, the first thing they see is your mindal self. They don't see your collection of molecules. I mean, they see your identity. You know, they'll see if in that mindal self there's that luminosity that's only there if there's an adjuster plugged into that mindal self.
Your real self.
Right. I mean, you know, especially they're going to first see your higher self that actually can be copied into soul, you know, and then they would see the lower self that can't be copied into soul, et cetera. See, like I said, they start with your higher mindal energy nature and penetrate down and out to your wholeness from there. You know, so you know, when I look to you, I see your body first and your mind second. But they see your mind first and your body second. Okay, they see you, you know, in the reciprocal the way I do.
The way I've resolved that to myself is just to put myself sort of in their position and see that it's the terrestrial escape the escape from the prison of the flesh that is so liberating that they know what's on the other side, and that's how I see it, and how they see us suffering and leaving the planet.
Yeah, and as long as, of course, you don't overplay the veil of tears sort of aspect of the body. Make sure you don't go too much with the history of the rationalization of the body. If bodies were only a negative phenomenon, if they were only a prison, they wouldn't exist. Material bodies wouldn't exist in the universe. You know, there's something that you can get with a material body that an angel will never have.
Yeah, there's that too.
Right, yeah, it works both ways. So don't quickly skip through this life, you know, so that you can be more at eye level with angels, like they tell you you're going to be in the next life. You know, make sure that you are enough here that you get what you can only get here. Because you'll regret it forever, you know, quote unquote. You don't get another chance, you know, unless you end up not fusing and getting onto Gerasim, and they need a prince's staff somewhere, and okay, then you can go back and be a sex creature again and do all those sorts of things again. But except for that, it's just this one chance to be down here at that lower level that the creative Mother Spirit, like we were just saying, it has only been down there for the last 2,000 years. Is she ready to quickly get out of it? No, she's been waiting forever to get down to it.
You're making your contribution and proud to do it.
Right, right. Okay, so you see, well, just one paragraph. There's just all kinds of things to think about there. All right, where do they take us next? Oh, you got something? Yeah.
One question. Because you think intellectually, can we mindfully talk to them because they come from the Mother Spirit?
No, yeah, I mean, right. Remember, we've emphasized this. I mean, you know, once you get beyond this life, you're moving quickly into a mode where all communication is mindily, right? I mean, so, you know, we've emphasized this. Your mind is an open book. I mean, they see your mind. They see all your thoughts, everything. I mean, you know, we've mentioned this many times, you know, when, you know, this always comes up, and everyone is like, well, I didn't give them permission to read all my thoughts. Well, that's not the way the universe works. I mean, not only do they see all your thoughts, but those beings on Uversa, you know, are probing every thought. I mean, everyone in the universe knows all your thoughts if they want to. Now, if you want to take some consolation, the ones that you're trying to hide, the ones you're embarrassed of, no one in the universe is really interested in all those lowly animal thoughts anyway. I mean, you're all wrapped around the axle because of, you know, St. Augustine or something, you know, and his, you know, musings about, you know, about sex or whatever. You know, and so we're all, you know, moralistic about these things. But, you know, I mean, the universe, you know, that's also, I mean, that's like, I mean, anyone who grew up on a farm, the biologic phenomena are pretty matter of fact to someone on a farm, you know. It's a very fact that fewer and fewer of us grow up with that kind of just being a matter of fact phenomenon that's happening all around you, and we grow up in a little cubicle in a city somewhere, you know, and it's all, right. Think about how they describe material sons and daughters, and, you know, yeah, I mean, okay, this is just, there's no issues here. You know, the only reason they wear clothes is because it's our norm on a mortal world, you know. But they're running around naked on Gerasim, okay. And again, you say, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to get used to that. No, you're not, because you're not going to have any of those kinds of sensuous emotions and sentiments up there. You're not going to think like that anymore. You just, you know, I mean, you know, and Adam and Eve have all the parts. I mean, there's, you know, they're sex procreating creatures. I mean, you're just not going to think about that stuff that way anymore. It's just not going to, you're not going to have any emotions or feelings tied to that level anymore. Right? So it'll all be just a matter of fact. All right. Well, that was delightfully real. Okay, but yeah, but that's, you know, that's part of what we're trying to get at here. We're trying to, you know, get over all of our foibles and think about this objectively. All right, let's see. I guess we were ready to start that second. Did we? Yeah, we haven't read any of that second paragraph, have we?
No.
Okay, I can't remember. How did we get off on that last tangent? Something that came up somewhere. Okay.
Loving them, and I was thinking how callous they must be.
Okay, go ahead.
Though seraphim are very affectionate and sympathetic beings, they are not sex emotion creatures. They are much as you will be on the mansion worlds, where you will neither marry nor be given in marriage, but will be as the angels of heaven. For all who shall be accounted worthy to attain the mansion worlds neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither do they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels. Nevertheless, in dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God, while referencing to the
referring.
Children, while referring to the children of the Spirit as the daughters of God. Angels are, therefore, commonly designated by feminine pronouns on the sex planets.
Okay, so you see that it's not just, you know, our evolutionary culture that has produced this notion to depict them, you know, in general, in feminine form. We obviously picked up on this long time ago through the various dispensational revelations, you know, in them being spoken of with feminine pronouns. Okay, so we just filled in the blanks anthropomorphically like we always do. Okay, so, you know, the prince's staff and whatnot would have been referring to them with feminine pronouns. Okay, well, that explains a lot just right there. That no wonder it's such a definitive thing in our you know, history of thought. Okay, now, okay, but up front again, you notice they juxtaposed. They, you know, the previous one, they said they love human beings. Like I said, you know, emphasizing that, you know, and they repeat it. You know, those seraphim are very affectionate and sympathetic beings. Okay, so they're trying to not have you lose that, the truth of that, but to make it less anthropomorphic. Okay, they are not sex emotion creatures. You know, so don't think of affection. You know, them being affectionate and sympathetic, predicated on hormones. It's like, well, I don't know anything else. Well, you know, that's part of the challenge, right? I mean, all of us to sort of come to terms with that.
So the part of the wonder of human intellect then is to be able to try to imagine that.
Right.
So what does that look like?
Yeah, right.
What does that look like? And various
exactly.
Various movie makers have tried to get that across, you know, with City of Angels type of ideas, and they can't divorce it from some of the anthropomorphic aspect
right.
of falling in love with a human being or whatever. But
right.
on the other hand, there is this divorcement from the idea of there having to be wings. There is this idea of they're thinking of your higher aspect. There's the idea that possibly the wonderful romantic idea that didn't have anything to do with sex emotion or anything was the idea that at sunrise, you know, the angels all faced the sunrise and all sang together for a few moments. And you can imagine that might not literally be a sunrise, but the administrative day begins on your rancho at a particular time. How is that marked by all the celestial beings?
Yeah.
How is it particularly marked by particular ones, like the angels?
Especially since, you know, as you know, I mean, there's many spots in the book where you know, they point to those sorts of moments of jubilation, you know, where everyone just kind of pauses and takes note of an event or whatever, you know, just for the sake of the joy of the event. You can see, I mean, what's going on here. I mean, they're really, you're not so much reading about angels, is they're using the passage about angels to try to help you to take your thoughts up to higher knots, challenge yourself. And you know it's going to be very difficult, like you were saying, because in this life, perforce, you serve two masters. You're not going to be able to literally do this in the way you'd like.
Unless you were a child of the 60s.
Well, unless you're floating and not connected to reality anymore, yeah.
They're all in rehab.
But you get my point. You know that if you're floating like that, you're not going to get any sort of a well-formed, you know, thought. That's obviously what's going on here, you know, and the fact that they literally bring in, you know, the Bible quotes from the Gospels there, you know, you've got Matthew and Mark, and then you've got the very similar passage from Luke, you know, in quotes there. You know, look at the nature of those paragraphs. I mean, are those passages from the Bible trying to inform you about the nature of angels first and foremost? No, they're trying to inform you of where you're going and where you should be trying to set your sights even now. You know, that when you go to the next life, you will neither marry nor be given in marriage. Okay? Right. See, and you can go down to rationalize that, you know, that magically you'll have your virginity restored. No, you're going up from that, you know, because we know it also tells you that the angels were made a little above you, right? Not a little below you, so you don't go down to be, you know, to be. Be as the angels of heaven there, quote unquote. You can obviously notice that they tweaked it a little bit. You know, the passage in Luke doesn't say attain the mansion worlds. Basically what they've done is just, instead of it's, you could translate it as, you know, attain that world. Well, they're saying, well, not just that world, the mansion worlds, you know, so that's how they've tweaked the passage. It's pretty close because it's speaking of, you know, the next life. Both of those, you know, they're trying to challenge you. Can you, in this life, as best you can, start to have feelings and emotions above the level of maleness and femaleness differential, something that is, you know, in that space that's immediately transcendent of that? It's like, well, maybe, but I don't know, what's the point of it? I mean, when I have an eternity to be working up the hierarchy, can I just sort of be what I am right now? If I'm going to have a true relationship, male to female, the only way I can have that true relationship is in the super additive consequence level of that. The only way that a husband and wife can be truly together as one is if they can produce a super additive consequence that transcends that male-female differential level. Because like the Revelators say, there is no meeting of the minds down there. Those are different. You're delusional if you think you're going to somehow glue yourself together down there. Okay? So if you've never taken delight in cultivating, having feelings, emotions, you know, me, if I've never taken delight in cultivating, having feelings and emotions above the basic male biologic level of my nature, I have no potential to have a relationship with a woman. I'm unrelatable to a woman, okay? And so, you know, this this should say a lot about the problem of between men and women on the planet in relationships. So see, that's between the lines here. If you reflect on what they're saying about angels, they're trying to encourage you into a state where naturally men and women can have real relationships. You know, same place where you can have real humor, real art, real music is where you can have real relationships. Something that's above the level of the flesh. Okay? And you know it's also going to be above the level of the feelings. You can't just go up, you know, that one notch. You know, that's just basically where you're feeling the flesh, right? Instead of just being the flesh, right? So, you know, you've got to go up. You've got to get above those, you know, basic animal origin levels in order to have real music, real art, real humor, real, you know, to have true monogamy, to have real relationships. I mean, if we want to get moving as a civilization, we got to get into those four indispensables of advancing civilization. One of those is true monogamy. Okay? You know, and if all of us are content with the kind of emotions and feelings we have as a male or a female biologic hormonal entity, there's no advancing civilization possible with such creatures. Right? There's too much drama in such creatures, right, to be advancing. And, you know, and there, you know, what kind of a God idea can a creature like that have? Nothing but an anthropomorphic one, right? What else could you have? You know, you're going to have a God that's either a male anthropomorphism or a female anthropomorphism, and they're going to have all of those male and female emotions and feelings and stuff, and that's just, you know, the revelators call that grotesque. For you to think about God like that.
Mount Olympus.
Right? Mount Olympus, right, or whatever. Right? All right, so, see, that's what's really going on here, you know. Remember, we're trying to discover what the truth is flowing through all these passages, why it's relevant to our lives. You know, how reading these two paragraphs about angels will transform human civilization. Okay, the mere facts of them doesn't do anything for human civilization. Right? You have to have the courage to face the truth in them and be evolved to something higher than you find yourself when you read it. Okay, what else? Do we have anything else that we need to bring out? There's that one other issue. There's some loaded things in here. You know, this is another spot where they're reminding you of how the language is being used in here. Okay, that statement, nevertheless, in dealing with sex creatures, it is our custom to speak of those beings of more direct descent from the Father and the Son as the sons of God. Okay. So when we get two papers hence, and we read about the ascending sons of God, we don't conclude that this book needs to be changed so it isn't, you know, so male-oriented in its language. Right? We're all ascending sons. It's like, you know, because where are you ascending to? Are you ascending to God the Mother? No. You're ascending to God the Father, okay, as an ascending son. You know, that you're using the word son to remind you of where, what relationship you're ascending in. Okay? So, but that's going to be a challenge if you've have a very simplistic idea about the use of pronouns and anthropomorphic deity and stuff like that. You've got to let go of, you know, of various male and female gods and those sorts of images.
Remember back in the 80s with the Boulder School for the Study of the Urantia, there were several ladies in the class screaming about it's a sexist book, thinking you've got to change it. Couple of them left because they could not cope with the constant he, she, he, where's the she? Where am I? I don't know. What's going on?
Right, and you know, I mean, how much have I talked about she and mother, you know, so far? You know, we've been going for an hour and a half. I haven't mentioned father that much, have I? No, I mean, because a lot of this is about the mother. But, you know, they're both in play, and the words are being used very precisely to indicate these relationships. you're a child of God the Mother, and precisely you're a son of God the Father. And it's like, well, I don't want to use the language like that. Well, what do you recommend?
Yeah.
See if you can come up with a better scheme than the Revelators have come up with. It's like, well, I think we should just make up a whole bunch of new words. Oh, so just sever all relationship to all the evolutionary history. Is that really the wisest solution? You know? Right. And again, you know, it eventually boils down to recognizing that they didn't make the fifth epical affirmation for you, where it uses all the language in the ignorant way that you've become accustomed to using the language, or want the language to be used, or some silly thing like that. And, invariably, there's going to be some sort of a challenge where you have to go up to come into relationship with it. And if you refuse to go up, well, then go sideways. Please. <You know? laughs> I mean, what's the point of just sitting there frozen, refusing to go up? Go elsewhere. All right. Let's see, I think we got everything there. All right, go ahead.
The seraphim are so created as to function on both spiritual and literal levels. There are a few phases of Morantia or spirit activity which are not open to their ministrations. While in personal status, angels are not so far removed from human beings, in certain functional performances, seraphim far transcend them. They possess many powers far beyond human comprehension. For example, you have been told that the very hairs of your head are numbered, and it is true they are, but a seraphim does not spend her time counting them and keeping the number corrected up to date. Angels possess inherent and automatic, that is, automatic as far as you could perceive, powers of knowing such things. You would truly regard a seraphim as a mathematical prodigy. Therefore, numerous duties, which would be tremendous tasks for mortals, are performed with exceeding ease by seraphim.
Okay, a couple things there we want to bring out. All right, so at the beginning, that might be, especially the beginning part, might be a little confusing. Okay, the seraphim are so created as to function on both spiritual and literal levels. Well, initially, we've been talking about how they certainly have a high ceiling to their nature. So maybe, you know, that helps you to wrap your mind around the spiritual part there. Okay, but let's think about it more precisely. It isn't as simple as that. You should be aware of that by the fact that they didn't say spiritual and material levels.
Yeah.
Okay. Why did they say literal?
Yeah.
Okay. So by literal there, that's related again to this. We're trying to think in more sophisticated fashion about energy systems that make bodies. Bodies that are definite and discrete. Okay. So in order for a body to be definite and discrete, even if it's a being that's very high relative to us spiritually, there has to be some individuality substance blended into it. Right? There is physical energy. So not so definitively using the word matter. Let's call it physical energy. There has to be some physical energy homogeneously blended in with that spirit energy, you know, to make a body that is individuated. I mean, if there isn't individuality substance, then it's illogical for the body to be individuated. That's why the Revelators, even the high Revelators, can't figure out how there's any logic to these beings on the Eternal Sun's worlds. They're told there's these beings. It's like, well, what does that even mean, they're saying? I mean, they don't have, if they're pure spirit energy, where's the individuality? It's just completely nonsensical, even to these high beings. Because all they can understand is just what's very logical. In order for you know, to be individuated, and hence, you know, that's what you mean by literal, that there's an individuality. You know, it has to be some physical energy to it in some fashion, at least a drop or two, right? Okay, so that's what they mean. So they can relate to individuality, you know, and over, you know, quite a spectrum, you know, vertical spectrum as well. And so when they say spiritual, in contrast to literal, they mean more, they can relate to just the unity phenomenon that might be there, that might be in play, where there's no entities, individuations, or anything. Like, say, the spirit presence of the creative mother spirit. You know, we talk about a spirit substrate a lot of times when we're thinking about spirit ministries as a modulation on that. I mean, any sort of a spirit presence where there's no even entity involved, it's just a spirit presence. Okay, they have a direct interface to that. So they have a direct interface to individualities and unity presences that might be in play. Okay, so that's what they mean by that. See, so there are few phases of Marantia or spirit activity that are not open to their ministrations. If they have, you know, the ability to relate to even very, very definitive individuality like us, you know, and something that really doesn't have any individuality to it at all, it's just a spirit presence throughout a whole space or something.
So yeah. The spirit of truth, they would be intimately
right.
They
have a very direct interface to spirit ministry, right? You know, and exactly, you know, how I'm supposed to think of it. Do they see it? Do they feel it? I mean, I don't know how to describe it. But yeah, it's going to be very, that's the point, is it's there's nothing indirect about their relationship to those ministries, the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, you know, all the other spirit presences. They have some very immediate, intimate linkage to that, association with that.
Don't they coordinate all of that?
Right, see, and they're intimately involved. That's why they're so intimately involved. You know, when they tell you, in terms of a functioning phenomenon, it's a lot of times it's very hard to separate, well, that's the Holy Spirit part, and that's the Spirit of Truth part, and that's the Thought Adjuster part, and that's the angel part. Remember, they throw the angel, you know. You have all four of those blurred together. If the angel is really in that spiritual interface mode, you know, it becomes part of that full unity of spirit ministry. But there would also be their individuality engagement of you that would be very obviously distinct. But they could be non-distinct and blurred in with the Holy Spirit, say, because of that, you know, because of that word spiritual there in that sentence. You know, and they're just sort of synchronizing with that in some way, you know, blending into it in some way and being part of it. Now, when they say, while in personal status, angels are not so far removed from human beings, do they mean that that existential personality, that spirit pattern that came from the Father and identified with them, is somehow a type of personality that's higher than yours? No. Right? I mean, there's just two types of personality that come from the Father, creator ones and creature ones. And all the creature ones are the same. And they're not higher and lower ones. The Father's just on one plane. They're all equal. So, you know, there's one of those cases when they say in personal status, they mean that personalized self, okay, obviously a little higher than your personalized self right now. I mean, it's definitely higher than my personalized self, because my personalized self is very, almost not even personal yet, you know, as we so often talk about. I have no problem admitting that I know I can manifest very little of my personality yet. All right, so it's going to be pretty easy to have a personalized self that's more profound than mine. Right? So that's what they mean by that.
They're not personalized by the infinite spirit?
No, they are personalized by the Father, and the Father's personality circuit. I mean, it's like, well, where does it say that? Well, just think logically. Can they end up in a part of the core of the finality? Yeah. And, you know, to do that, they have to have a Father fragment, you know, even, see. So, yeah. So, yes, even though the Creative Mother Spirit is a third source personality, these daughters of hers are first source personalities. So that makes them even more a lot like us. All right, let's see. Okay, then they go into the mode. Okay, so in terms of just how significant, you know, I mean, in just a sort of a general sense, the personalized self, what level is it at? You know, it isn't that much higher than ours, in just a general sense. But some of the specific details of the self that's personalized is a kind of self that's pretty unfamiliar to us, but not totally unfamiliar. Because, you know, when you read, you know, and they quote again out of the Gospels about the very hairs your head are numbered, you know, and that the angel doesn't count those hairs, they just know how many hairs there are. You, if you're thinking about it, you should go, well, wait a minute, there are humans that can do that. All right. You know, so between the lines is an aha of recognition of what's going on with a savant. When you have a someone with, you know, what they call savant syndrome, okay, that's, you know, I mean, obviously there's something abnormal about their mindedness, you know, specifically what's going on. I mean, they are taking a hold of the mind energy system in a way that is not that different, at least in part, to what an angel, the way an angel grabs a hold of the mind energy system, even though the angel's not using adjutant mind. Little reminder that it is all her mind. Okay, I mean, in a sense, the kind of mind that the angel is using, if you just downstep that so that it individuates, you have adjutant mind. You know? So a savant is, in a sense, he kind of going up through the mind energy system and grabbing a hold of a, using the mind sort of a bit transadjutant, you know, in a more holistic way, and tuning in and being able to have this very non-linear consciousness about, you know, just how many uncountable objects are in front of him. And sure enough, you spend 3 hours counting them, and that's exactly how many there are. You know, that savant somehow just looked at it and knew that. Right. And that's because there's a, you know, mother deity is bringing that mind into association with those in a non-linear fashion, and mind knows, and it, you know, it just knows how many things it's touching without counting them. Okay. Okay, so, you know, that, you know, that's has a lot of bearing on things that we experience. You know, to not think of that abnormality in the way that it's, you know, humans have tended to think about it. It's actually kind of a curious thing. But you notice, you know, in general, in order for someone to go up like that and get a hold of a little savant-like, you know, ability, they basically have to disconnect from everything down below. And so that, you know those individuals very, very rarely can have any relationship to the external world and stuff in any sort of a normal way. Because see, most, you know, the tiny little bit of consciousness that we can have is mostly all up too high where it's not supposed to be. And so there's nothing left to be able to be an associating mechanism consciousness that can engage the, you know, external world and others in some, you know, semblance of sanity, right? You know, so they tend to be, you know, very autistic, you know, for instance, you know, very self-absorbed. You know, they don't have enough left to get out. You know, everything that's, you know, the inside is up too high where it can't get out. You know, it has to come down in order to get out. You
know?
You're talking about angels here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Would it be just as dark to them as it would be for
us? I would say that they could think about it in the darkness that you think about it, but they don't have to. They have the ability to sense it in more ways and know of it in more ways than we do. So when the world goes dark to us, it doesn't go dark to them. But they could also see that if you look at it that way, it's dark, right? Because, you know, they just told us that they have no problem seeing, thinking, you know, relating to how you are associated with the external world. But they have a lot more above that. And that's kind of what we were just talking about. See, this is an individual that's going up and having a little bit of a connection to the external world, like they do. But in the process, they lose most of what we normally have as a way of connecting the external world.
Plus, you know they're just going to light up the room anyway.
Here is that spirit luminosity thing or whatever, yes. Right, but that, you know, just bringing up that you're going to light up the room. Remember, you know, I think we mentioned that last time, didn't we? That whole curious thing about higher luminosities, if you will, or other luminosities of things, you know, that are obviously referred to in the Revelation, and exactly how you think about that. You know, we think, you know, when you think about material luminosity, it's pretty straightforward because, okay, you're in an individuality energy. So, you know, you can literally think about little packets of physical energy going from point A to point B and illuminating point B. Well, when you're with spirit energy, the unity substance, okay, and it's not individuated, how do I think about a vector illumination like that? We have no way to think about such things. You know, that's why the Revelators say, I mean, you can't even remotely contemplate the first mansion world yet. I mean, the energy environment and associativity of everything is just so beyond your comprehension right now. You think in such simple, crude fashion. You know, so you can't even imagine spirit luminosity. And that's sort of just the most matter-of-fact background sort of a thing, you know? So anyway.
But we did get the luminosity from the material sons and daughters, or Adam and Eve. When they were clothed, they still have that.
Right, but again, see, that's just a material. I mean, the reason you can see it is because they're literally giving off photons, okay? Okay, they aren't giving off some magical light or something. I mean, it's literal photons, you know, and fairly high energy ones. That's why it's in the violet. You know, like I said, it's probably into the ultraviolet a little bit. Yeah, you know, right. So you can smell ozone around a little bit and get a tan, you know, if you stand by them too long. It's just literal like that, right? You know, because that's, you know, that higher type of mechanical mind that engages their body. I mean, you just literally have a high energy interaction phenomenon between that mechanical mind and their molecular structure, and it's literally, you know, producing photons, making them radiate. Yeah. Okay, just maybe one other little thing, the little parenthetical they threw in there. You know, they said that is automatic as far as you could perceive. You know, and they're talking about this, you know, ability to do the savant-like thing. You know, they threw that in there so that you don't start thinking magically about it. Okay. You know, they don't magically know this. I mean, they have to still decide to focus their attention on something and acquire that information. You know, just like you would have to focus your attention on counting them. So it's not, you know, instantaneous, and it's not, you know, it's not something that you know, their body just does, and they, stop that, I don't want to know how many hairs there are, you know. No, I mean, they have, you know, they decide to know that bit, okay? You know, so that's what they're trying to get you to appreciate.
Your hair count out of
the head. All right, every time I erase it, I get the count again. That's why they threw in that, just so you think about the mechanics of it, think logically about it. Right. It's all very much under their control, their conscious control. All right.
Chris,
yeah. Oh.
One more question.
Mm-hmm.
In the third sentence on this paragraph, is there a reason they differentiate between angel and seraphim?
Let's see. Third sentence. We are where?
Wow.
One, two. Oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you want, I mean, obviously, initially you could just think of it as a synonym and them reminding you that what you've called angels, in general, you should think of that as being specifically seraphim. So it has that evolutional immediacy to it. But it also serves double duty. If you think about more than seraphim, you know, while in personal status, you know, not just seraphim, but cherubim, sanabim, you know, the lesser order of angels, you know, all of them are not far removed from human beings. Okay, see, so it does provide that ability to go beyond the immediacy of it and appreciate, you know, that the word angel is technically a generalizable term, right? And it's not just applied to seraphim. You know, but then they immediately bring it back to the specific point and say seraphim. Okay.
Angels are superior to you in spiritual status, but they are not your judges or accusers. No matter what your faults, the angels, although greater in power and might, bring no accusation against you. Angels do not sit in judgment on mankind. Neither should individual mortals prejudge their fellow creatures.
Okay, let's start with the angels. Okay, and again, you know, they're sort of grabbing every significant little angel passage they can. Okay, so they're tapping Peter again there. That's Second Peter. You know, notice the, you know, the immediate consequences that they're trying to bring into play. First of all, about just you yourself. No matter what your, see, you know, they didn't say one's faults. They lifted their finger up and pointed right at you. No matter what your faults. Okay, the angels, although greater in power and might, bring no accusation against you. Okay, so we were just talking about that. You know, the fact that they can see every thought in your head, high and low. They don't need a translator or a transformer. It's just right there in front of them. They can see every mind energy form in your, you know, that you have a hold of. They're not looking at you in some sort of a judgmental mode. Certainly not what we usually think about that is some sort of existential judgmental mode, you know, that you're good or bad. Right, you just are. You know, they were, well, next time we get into more of the details about them, I mean, they go through a lot of training to become very comfortable with the lowly specifics of an animal origin creature before they're sent out into ministry with us. Okay, so there's, so because they need to be in this very matter-of-fact mode. Nothing surprises them, nothing embarrasses them, nothing, you know, anything you can think of. Okay, and so they're engaging you very objectively and very understandingly. Okay, so that is in play, but you notice they pointed the finger at you and said you're, because they want you to really take a hold of this. Again, here you don't have to read between the lines. They literally put it in the sentence what you're supposed to be getting out of this, you know. And it's not so much about the properties of angels. It's about what you should be challenging yourself to do. Angels do not sit in judgment on mankind. Neither should individual mortals prejudge their fellow creatures. Right. I mean, that's just sort of just sticking in your face. Again, if you want to think about yourself as a very enlightened spiritual person, okay, that has consequences. You need to live up to that. What's initially a delusion. Okay, you need to take on the facts of that, you know, just to get up a notch or two and be kind of at eye level with a seraphim means you need to transcend all of the way humans are normally portrayed in literature and, you know, in theater. You need to get above that melodramatic drama, you know, level. We were just talking about that. How do you do that? You do that by getting up above being a phenomenon that's dominated by that biologic expression as male and female, where most of your mind energy forms are literally seated more on molecules that are floating around in your body than they are on DNA strands. You know, they're literally seated on a testosterone, you know, molecule floating around in you. Okay, that's, you know, it's not going to do it. You know, so challenging yourself to, you know, to try to take on what you can do. You can be, I mean, if you can just have a little bit of an aberration in genetic expression, and you can have a savant, you know, telling you how many matches are on the floor when you dump the box of matches on the floor, you know, we can do this. You know, just a little bit of effort, and you can take on some of the more relevant aspects of an angel. Who cares if you can count, you know, the number of hairs on someone's head? But if you can live a less judgmental life, in that negative sense of it, prejudging, that would be fantastic for civilization. Yeah, so, you know, we all know that how many times I do the preconceived opinion, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. Okay, and you can all remind yourselves how many people there are on the planet that your first tendency is to not listen to what they say, because they're on some, they're on the other side of some line. You know, you've prejudged them.
I think I came up with something today that was pretty amazing to me, and it was, I was looking at the word forgive. Mm-hmm. That it's giving before.
Yeah.
Never had thought about that before. And it goes along with the prejudging. You're paying the forgiveness ahead.
Right.
There's nothing to forgive.
Exactly. That's why I've tried to explain. I mean, the true definition of the word forgiveness is patient love. Mm. Right? It isn't a reactionary phenomenon.
Right.
You've done it before.
Yeah.
You've done it always. If you are patient love, you're automatically forgiving. I mean, that's why God is so automatically forgiving. You know, an eternal being is pretty patient. There's no relationship to time. Okay. That's the mode. How can angels be like they are, like we've been talking about all night? They've just taken it up a notch, where they're not so much down there bobbing along like a cork, in the ocean. Get yourself up, and you'll become much more stable in all kinds of different ways. Now, there's going to be a corollary to that. You're not going to be so intensely biologically passionate. So you have to be willing to let that fade away. And, if you can't, I mean, God has a technique, you know, for this. he severs us from that very shortly. Right? So, you know, we're a little reflective. It's like, well, okay, maybe I should try it. it's probably a good thing if I try it a little bit. But it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing because, look, you know, what did they mention? Music, art, humor? Those, I mean, you know, in general, calling them artists, an awful lot of what powers an artist, at least historically, is a lot of intimate relationship with that bobbing cork level of reality. I mean, that's what gets you all impassioned to write that song? You know, it's because, you know, daddy gave your dog away or whatever. Okay?
And I mean, for it.
You know, and we all know, you know, there's been a couple songs written about that tension between the biology of a male and a female. Mm. Song or two, maybe a couple paintings. Right? You know, and you know, I think a lot of artists kind of recognize that if they do what God is expecting of them and go up a little bit, they're going to lose kind of what's been powering their livelihood, maybe even. So, you know, it's a tricky thing. I mean, you have to, in order for individuals to go up, the whole society has to go up. I mean, you can still be a musician at a much higher level, but there has to be a culture that appreciates music at a higher level. Yeah. See, so it's kind of a catch-22 situation. You know, if you go up like you know you must, you're probably going to have to, you know, you're no longer going to be relevant to most people. They're not going to appreciate what you have to offer anymore. So you're not going to make a living at it. So that's tricky. You know, you got to work that out. You got to try to balance between the material, you know, pragmatic facts of life on this benighted sphere, you know, and that, you know, the more crude your humor, the more likely you are to make a lot of money as a comedian. Okay, unless you're really, really gifted. And even that's less possible because even the audience for a really sophisticated non-crude humorist is fading away. It's sad to record that fewer and fewer people have any interest, you know, in something that isn't crude. So, you know, this is a very typical thing, in my opinion, for artists, you know, to really think about what the revelation is saying so explicitly and challenging us, you know, kind of what we always know, but it's putting it so right in front of us now. You know, you've got to come to terms with some very difficult things like this. Let's see, yeah, we better finish up here. We're almost out of time here. Okay, what else do we have here?
You will do well to love them, but you should not adore them. Angels are not objects of worship. The great seraphim, Lorelatia, when your seer fell down to worship before the feet of the angel, said, "See that you do it not. I am a fellow servant with you and with your races, who are all enjoined to worship God."
Okay, if you don't know, the quote-unquote seer is, of course, the Apostle John. Or, you know, we're quoting from Revelation there. I mean, that specific one with all of that detail is literally right at the end of the book of Revelation. You know, curious that they decided to actually coin an English name. That's a fascinating thing, but they did. So they used that to just stress the obvious that, but look at the significant things there. You do well to love them, but you should not adore them. Can you differentiate those two words? Is there a difference between the word adoration and the word love in your mind? You know, we all know when you get into really thinking about the word worship in the Revelation, that's another challenge they put, you know, try to get you to separate adoration from worship. You know, it's especially difficult because a lot of times they, you know, use the word worship where, you know, adoration is combined in with it, and they don't tell you that they've blended it together, but, you know, kind of in a more evolutional mode where, you know, technically what we think of as and call worship is adoration. You know, we're trying to talk to God, you know, an oration to God, adoration, right? You know, but they're saying, well, technically, if you're going to get a message from you to God, there has to be a substrate upon which you, you know, transmit that message. And technically, that's what worship is synchronizing, you know, with that cosmic substrate, you know, that message is going to travel along. You know, similar thing here, you know. You know, if you, even if you separate adoration from worship, can you separate love from adoration? Right? Did the Apostle John immediately separate love from adoration? No, he immediately was feeling love and dropped down on his knees. Right? And wanted to worship. Yeah, technically. Adore the angel. All right, and then the last part there.
In nature and personality endowment, the seraphim are just a trifle ahead of mortal races in the scale of creature existence. Indeed, when you are delivered from the flesh, you become very much like them. On the mansion worlds, you will begin to appreciate the seraphim. On the consolation spheres, to enjoy them. While on Salvington, they will share their places of rest and worship with you. Throughout the whole Morontia and subsequent spirit ascent, your fraternity with the seraphim will be ideal. Your companionship will be superb.
So that's a pretty fun little way to wrap it up and give you all of that to look forward to. You know, even bunking with them there, which is pretty fun. Share their places of rest and worship. And how those two are together as one, which is a cool thing. But again, let me just stress it because they do it again. In nature and personality endowment. Again, what do we mean there? We don't mean they have a higher grade personality from the Father than we do. Okay, it just means that they have a self that naturally more personality can manifest through to start with. But when you're standing side by side with a seraphim as fellow finaliters, I mean, do they have, a higher personality? No. Endowment? No. So it's just an issue of, right now, very little personality can come through this. And it's, if the simplest way to understand it, do I have any spirit substance in my body? No. Personality is spirit pattern. So not a lot of spirit pattern is going to be able to manifest through this. It's just going to be in a very indirect way. They have literal spirit substance in their body. Okay, so it's just automatic that more personality can express through the kind of mind that seats on that kind of body, as opposed to the kind of mind that seats on this kind of body. The mind is not seated on spirit substance at all. The spirit I have a relationship to is above it and just tenuously, dependent on me having some faith grasp up to it. So very little personality can manifest through this. Yeah.
It's a challenge too to think about personality as being unique. These seraphim are brought into being or created in groups of 41,472, all essentially the same.
Yeah.
But they each have a unique personality associated with each one.
Yeah.
In my crude way of thinking, how is that possible?
Well, especially when you start to get into reading some of the things about them, they start talking about them like they were machines, and latching onto energy lines and all this sort of stuff and having polarity, and you're going, well, that doesn't sound like a person at all. It sounds like some sort of fancy gizmo or something, we saw that with some of the other beings. Right? It's always a challenge to think about a lot of the technical aspects of themselves, or especially if they're in a mode where they're not really ascending and they're just sort of doing this very stationary grinding work, millennia after millennia, which depersonalizes them for us. You think, well, that's just a machine. Only a machine could stand to just grind like that for hundreds of millions of years in the same task, It's very hard for us, but they are just as much persons as we are.
But I wouldn't think of them as being in being projected in unit formation. That's hardly an individuality or hardly a very similar kind of projection. There's a 12-fold on 12-fold on 12-fold on 12-fold projection, you know, of identity. That's why they're talking about those pattern angels. There's 12 distinct mind types, and that's where the, what we were in the life carrier papers just before, they were talking about the 4 and 20 mm-hmm. types of psychic organization. That's something that's reflected in our minds as well, and it's very, very important, and that's how they're related to us as well.
Yeah, I mean, but you notice, I mean, I was going to mention a similar sort of thing, you know, when we get to the next paper, we get into all of these differences, you know, in them and stuff. I mean, but you notice they're what they're stressing up front is despite all of the natural differences that they have, that they all don't just come out 41,472 vanillas, you know, they're choosing to put that second in the discussion. Up front, they're reminding you of not only is there some similarity amongst that, you know, upwards of 40,000, but every seraphim in the entire grand universe, you know, has a commonality. They're putting that first. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're trying to get you to think about angels top down. Mm-hmm. Start at the top where they're basically all identical. And then if you're going to think about their differences, appreciate where those lie. They lie as you penetrate the angel down more and more in relationship to the details. They start with a lot of unity-like, and we just did the spiritual and literal, right? So they start with a lot of very fundamental unity, commonality, and then they can penetrate down into individuality, and when they do, they differentiate with all kinds of specificity. Okay, you see that? It's just important to they want you to fundamentally think of them as coming into existence top down, as opposed to you that are so bottom up. That's one of the things that's fundamentally different about the two of us. And so even when they become an ascending being and ascend with us, they end up being a different flavor, finaliter, than we can ever be, because they have a little bit of top down built into them, you know, and we're just completely bottom up to get to the Isle of Paradise. So that'll, you know, that's why they're mentioned as the distinct individuals. They don't just lump them indistinguishably in with us, you know, in the core of the finality. And the quicker.
This may want to take this after, but why did any seraphims fail in the rebellion and why?
Yes, many seraphim failed in the rebellion, and you know our rebellion, other rebellions, all rebellions. Why? Because they're not that much different than we are. Same way that you could go astray, they can go astray. They're definitively below the integrous level of beings in the universe. Right, and then on top of that, they you know they didn't even have the potential to have a thought adjuster. Even when they get into the core of finality, it's not by getting a thought adjuster; it's a different type of father fragment. You know, and that only happens you know clear at the end of the game there. Right, so you know throughout their whole ascension career, they don't have a father fragment. So think about how much that alters, you know, the kind of finaliter that they are, you know. There's all kinds of differences. Right. But that's, yeah, I mean, basically it's just, you know, the very fact that you can just take a little hop up and be kind of like them, you know, unless you believe in the old style transformation when you die, where the moment you die, you're then a perfect being at the right hand of the Father, you know, that little hop that you take up is not going to take you very far. You know, you don't immediately, you know, aren't immediately fusing on the first imagined world or something, right? So you're definitely in a mode when you're a lot like them where you can go astray and so can they. All right, let's wrap it up there and we'll keep on here next time.